I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 5.5 years ago, long before there was anything called a war on terror, the greatest threat to world peace was thought to be along the border between India and Pakistan. First, India set off a series of nuclear explosions, then Pakistan responded with its own. And that nation's lead scientist, Abdul Qadir Khan, or A.Q. Khan, was praised like a savior. In posters and parades, Khan was lauded. He was, they said, the father of the Islamic bomb. Earlier this week, a chastened and humiliated Khan appeared on Pakistan television, admitting that he personally had been caught selling nuclear secrets to nations like Libya, North Korea, and Iran.
Much of it is true. I take full responsibility for my actions and seek your pardon. I give an assurance, my dear brothers and sisters, that such activities will never take place in the future.
Today on The Connection, we look at just what is known about this clandestine nuclear network. But we also want to focus on how this changes, or should change, the relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan. They are, after all, partners in this so-called war on terror. Is it even credible to imagine that the scientist, A.Q. Khan, was acting alone? Or was Pakistan's military part of the underground trade in nuclear technology? Pakistan's military leader, General Pervez Musharraf, is making it clear that those questions won't be open to international consideration.
Nobody comes inside and checks our things. We check them ourselves. So this is a sovereign country. Nobody, no document will be given. No independent investigation will take place here. And we will not submit to any United Nations coming inside here.
So, what is the U.S. to do? The Bush administration's whole case for preemption is built on its hunt for weapons of mass destruction and the illegal trade in such weapons. So, now that it's clear Pakistan is at the center of this, is it time for the U.S. to reconsider this partnership? How much is U.S. credibility at stake now? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us today, Ahmed Rashid. He is a writer and a journalist, a correspondent with the Far Eastern Economic Review. He's joining us on the line from his home in Lahore, Pakistan. Ahmed, it's nice to have you back on The Connection.
Thank you.
Kathy Gannon is also with us. She's the Associated Press Bureau Chief based in Islamabad. She's joining us today from a studio in New York City, where she's spending time as a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. Kathy, nice to have you back as well.
Thank you very much, Dick.
Let me start with you, Kathy, and on this week's news. How big a deal is this? If lights really start shining around in places where Pakistan was dealing its nuclear secrets in the last 25 years, how big a deal is that going to be?
Well, I think it's a very big deal. And I think that what it does is, at the beginning you said, you know, Pakistan's dirty secret. I think it's the Pakistan military's dirty secret. And I think that really it highlights the problem of having the military in Pakistan constantly as the only ally of the U.S. Consistently, the U.S. makes the Pakistan military, whether it was the Al-Haq in the 80s, and again now in the 90s and 2000, is the Pakistan military. It seems inconceivable that A.Q. Khan could have sold nuclear secrets to, say, North Korea for missile technology, and that the military would not have been a partner in that to gain military technology. And I think you have to look at closely at the military. Maybe this is a good thing in the long run in terms of having the a real look at the military in Pakistan and look at how they have consistently undermined the civil society in Pakistan, how Pakistanis suffer at the hands of the military in the long run. And so you get a lack of stability in the country that is not reflective of Pakistanis and the desire of Pakistanis, but reflective of the military and its alliances with the extremist elements in Pakistan, alliances with militants.
Kathy, let me just take the first thing that you said and test that with Ahmed Rashid. Ahmed, is there anybody in Pakistan today who believes that A.Q. Khan was acting on his own, was dealing with North Korea and Libya and Iran and Sri Lanka and the European connection and all that stuff all on his own?
No, there's really nobody who believes that. I mean, whether you're a fundamentalist Islamic politician or person where you believe that Khan is a hero and that there was nothing wrong in proliferating, but they are very angry that the military has fingered him and absolved itself. Or if you're a liberal, a Democrat in Pakistan, and of course you don't believe in proliferation and you think it's a bad idea anyway to start with, once again, they are very angry because, again, the military has absolved itself of any kind of responsibility for what has happened.
Ahmed, just give us the context of today's news. There were supposed to be rallies and a general strike across the country, held in support of Khan to criticize Musharraf for forcing this man to fall on his sword. And based on what I'm seeing in the news wires, that pretty well fell flat.
Yes, it did. The opposition is divided on this issue. The mainstream opposition parties didn't join this protest. The religious parties tried to have a kind of strike and a protest, but it was very patchy. There was a little bit of violence in Karachi where some 50 people were arrested, where there was some stoning and tear gas at the crowd by the police. But elsewhere in the country, it's been pretty peaceful, and really the strike was not successful.
So then how do you measure the impact of the apology? Khan, so much a hero back in 1998, humiliating himself on television. Did people feel sorry for them? Did they feel angry that they'd been duped? What was the feeling in Pakistan?
I think people were very angry, and of course it depended on what kind of viewpoint, political viewpoint, you were coming from. But overall, people were very angry. And yesterday, the spectacle of seeing President Musharraf spend half his press conference attacking the Pakistani press and Pakistani intellectuals and politicians and almost every element of civil society for, as he said, defaming Pakistan and giving quotations to the foreign media and a crying wolf. Yesterday we saw the military accusing everyone else of being unpatriotic, unnationalistic, and only the military itself knowing what is right for everyone.
Okay, which brings us back to where Kathy was talking earlier about the power of the military, and it's something I want to pursue further with both of you in just a couple of minutes. But Kathy, a bit of history here. Now, A.Q. Khan is a name well known in Pakistan. Many of us here in this country are reading about him for the first time this week. His nuclear connections go back some 30 years, and it's not a very savory history, is it?
Well, yeah, the report is that he actually brought the centrifugal system of enrichment to Pakistan, having taken it from the Dutch, having stolen it himself from the Dutch. So I think the very beginnings of A.Q. Khan's nuclear program in Pakistan and Pakistan's nuclear program is sort of based on a stolen information in the first place, which in itself gives you an indication of how that's 30-some years ago. Mm-hmm. So the theft of nuclear technology didn't necessarily begin with Pakistan or it's certainly not something that is new to, 2004 so I think that also has to be looked at, what kind of network is in place? Has there been any movement progress on dismantling whatever networks might be in place in terms of how to move heavy water, how to move emerging steel, how to move the components as well as the technology? Has that network been removed? So I think that's a real issue that has to be looked at as well. As far as Pakistan's history or the Pakistani military and A.Q. Khan, their program begins with stolen technology in the first place.
Okay, but let's just scan that past 30 years, mm-hmm. though, Kathy, because A.Q. Khan has been the nuclear star in that country for that period of time. He has spanned six different leaders in Pakistan. I remember back in the late 90s when he was being praised as the father of the Islamic bomb, the people were saying, gee, the guy's got 11 houses in Islamabad alone. He's a very wealthy man. Is it possible to imagine that he was in any way selling secrets on his own network, or did all the leaders, the prime ministers and the generals, have to know at the same time?
Sure. Dick, I think you're absolutely right. First, The military has always been in charge of the nuclear program. Successive civilian governments in Pakistan have always been covertly run by the military. They've been dismissed by the at the behest of the military. But the nuclear program has been in the hands of the military during Zia-ul-Haq's time, consistently throughout Pakistan's history, nuclear history. It is inconceivable, as Amit so rightly said, that the AQ Khan individually could have sold secrets in exchange for not just money, but technology, missile technology. It is just logically speaking, that he would come back with missile technology from North Korea, for example, for the Nodong missile, that the military, which is developing the missile program, is not going to say, well, and how did this missile technology come into our hands? And you don't have a budget for technology, missile development. Just logically looking at what was supposed to have been given, independent of just money for in exchange, the military had to be involved. And money, you're not talking about just millions or hundreds of millions. Aslam Beg, who was Army Chief of Staff back in 89, 90, said that Iran had come and offered up to $10 billion for nuclear technology. He says that, of course, they didn't sell it to them. But he was Army Chief of Staff at the time. And he says that as Army Chief of Staff, he was approached and offered by emissaries for Iran, offering up to $10 billion. It's very difficult to imagine that just one person made all that money and the military suddenly in 2004 woke up and said, my goodness, how did that happen?
Okay, let me turn to Ahmed Rashid if I can, because we listened to General Musharraf at the beginning of the program say, nobody's coming in here to look at what we've got, saying in effect directly to the IAEA that no documents, no inspections will be allowed. Does that create a real dilemma for the United States, its continued partnership with Pakistan, Amit?
Well, I think, you know, the very strong feeling here amongst many Pakistani experts and the media is that there is already a deal in place with the U.S. and the IAEA. In fact, he was very contradictory yesterday in the press conference. What he made those comments saying nobody will come here, and then later on he said, well, of course we will cooperate with anyone who might be interested in trying to find out exactly what happened. So I think the very strong feeling is that given the fact that the Bush administration has endorsed everything that Musharraf has done over the last few days, I think there is a feeling that there is going to be access possibly by the IAEA to what has happened in Pakistan. Let me just remind you that back in 2001 in March, when Qadir Khan was actually sacked as head of the Khan Research Laboratories, in fact, as head of the nuclear program, it was done under U.S. pressure. The U.S. had told Musharraf that Khan had been proliferating, or the military had been proliferating, to North Korea, and the matter was hushed up at the time. Khan was investigated by the military in secret and found to have made a great deal of money, and the Americans just didn't seem to push it at that time.
All right, we'll pick that up when we come back after the break. 1-800-423-8255. Big questions for the United States here, involved as they have been, as Amit's just pointing out, in this controversy for much longer than has been necessarily public. But does the U.S. continue its partnership with Pakistan now? This is all on the table. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. This hour we're talking about the change, or the challenge of change, in the relationship between the United States and Pakistan, with news this week that Pakistan's lead nuclear scientist has been selling secrets from that country to Libya, to North Korea, as well as to Iran. Perhaps that network reaches a little bit further, a dilemma for the Bush administration, which has pinned so much of its war on terror on its relationship with Pakistan. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Joining me on the program today, Ahmed Rashid. He is a Pakistani author and journalist. His two most recent books, Taliban, Islam, Oil, and the New Great Game in Central Asia, as well as Jihad, the Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. Kathy Gannon's joining us from a studio in New York City, though we normally have her with us from Islamabad, where she's bureau chief for Associated Press, was in fact nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for her work there a couple of years ago, and winner of the International Women's Media Foundation Courage in Journalism Award. We want to go to our callers and see what you're thinking here. To Framingham, Massachusetts, Rajesh is with us. Rajesh, thanks for calling.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to make a statement that if this controversy does not expose U.S. foreign policy for what it is, I'm not really sure what else will.
Well, what is it, Rajesh? What is it that you want exposed?
The United States, with its extensive intelligence gathering that's happened over the years, has clearly known that Pakistan has been proliferating for years. I mean, people might make a statement one way or the other saying that the U.S. Screwed up so badly in Iraq, so it's likely that they could have screwed up in Pakistan also, but I don't think that's very likely because the U.S. has been involved with Pakistan for much longer
right.
and on much more friendlier terms, that they should have known this and they have known this all along. But for some reason, successive American administrations seem to just close their eyes to the atrocities Pakistan commits and proliferates.
Okay, Rajesh, let's talk about the here and now, if we can, and I'm going to bring Kathy in on this, because, Kathy, if the United States, if the folks in Washington were to be sitting around this morning saying, my God, what have we done making friends with Musharraf, and maybe this is going to give us all kinds of difficulty. I mean, there's going to be people around that table who say, hey, we have no choice. As long as we're going to be hunting bin Laden, as long as we need to operate in Afghanistan, we must remain friends with who's ever in charge in Pakistan. Is it that simple? Is it that black and white?
No, I don't think so. I think that there certainly are options, and I think that the U.S. Administration in its allies, in choosing allies in Pakistan, has consistently chosen the military. The military has consistently undermined the civil society, and I think that really this is now the time for the U.S. administration and the international community to look at it and say, listen, this is where you build up the civil society. This is where you return political parties and develop, help Pakistan develop a culture of political parties, develop its civil society, take the military to task. And instead of lumping all of Pakistan with the military, which consistently happens, it really is unfair to Pakistan and to what is possible. And since the military, this last bout of military rule, the Islamic right wing has gained in political power, gained in significance, which consistently, when Pakistanis have had a chance to vote, they have not voted these people in. It's only under the military that they gain in strength, which continues to haunt both Pakistanis after the U.S. leaves and the international community. And I think this is a real chance to get involved. You know, you say partnership with Pakistan. It's not a partnership with Pakistan. It's a partnership with the Pakistan military for short-term goals. It's time to say, okay, how do we get into some long-term commitments and really look long-term to bring stability to the region?
Right,
and that means some hard choices that I don't think they've made yet.
Ahmed Rashid, these hard choices, these options that Kathy's talking about, are there opposition parties ready to work with U.S. diplomats to say, no, we're ready to build a civil society? Certainly in the time that I was covering Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif, those parties were about as corrupt as anything in South Asia.
Well, first of all, I mean, let me just say I agree with Kathy completely. But, you know, it's been an end result here where you had a period of democracy in the 90s, which was very flawed, but where the military was constantly intervening and dismissing governments. No elected government in Pakistan has ever fulfilled its term of office, 4 or 5 years in office. They've always been dismissed after 1 or 2 years. Now you have, you know, very stunted political growth, very stunted democracy. Last year, for example, I mean, a lot of people were arguing with the Americans when Musharraf had these elections, which were very dubious and highly manipulated by the military. Mm-hmm. You had an argument in Washington, which was basically telling the Bush people that, look, I mean, you should tell the the military to have a free and fair election and genuinely, at least for a period of time, share power with the politicians. What we have today is a situation where you have an elected government, a prime minister, a parliament, but the military runs the whole show. I mean, who in the last 3 weeks has heard of Prime Minister Zafrullah Khan Jamali? Has he had any say in what has happened? All you've been hearing about is Qadir Khan and Musharraf,
yeah.
Which I think points to the fact that, you know, the military remains so dominant and so much in control, and partly that is due to the support it has received from the United States.
So Kathy, give me one example of a way in then.
Political parties. You're right, Dick, that they were very corrupt. But, you know, you have to develop a political culture. It doesn't happen overnight. And Benazir Bhutto, who was she? Her first job was Prime Minister of Pakistan. Who was Nawaz Sharif? He was created by Zia-ul-Haq, who was a military ruler. You have to develop a political culture. You get in there and you develop. You work with politicians. There are politicians in Pakistan. There are political parties. The Pakistan People's Party, never mind the leadership. The parties. Look at the parties. Look at the party structure. Work with them to develop the political parties, public education. Get in there big time with public education, not this moderating madrasas. You can't moderate madrasas. Have the government, the military, despite its rhetoric, has done nothing, have them actually treat madrasas the way you treat seminaries. Limit them to control them, regulate them, to turn out just mullahs. You've got X number of mosques, X number of mullahs, like seminaries. You don't moderate a seminary to moderate priests. You have what they are. Instead, they are an alternative to education in Pakistan. That is wrong. The military, since it came in 1999, has talked about regulating madrasas, moderating them, done nothing. You cannot moderate a madrasa, but you can say, okay, a madrasa is like a seminary. You turn out mullahs. You've got X number of mosques. You need X number of mullahs.
All right,
then you regulate what kind of course. There's lots that can be done, Dick.
Back to our callers. To Raleigh, North Carolina. Ajay's calling us. Ajay, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I just wanted to express my opinion and how the U.S. administration is keeping such a blind eye on what Pakistan's military regime is doing. On one hand, when they say they talk about axis of evil, like countries like Iran, Libya, and North Korea, they are ready to take any action. But on the other hand, the country who's supplying all the nuclear technology to those countries, they say that it's their internal affair. I can't understand that.
So Ajay, would you have the current administration in Washington say, right, that's it, no more contact with Musharraf?
Yeah, and another point.
Okay, so you're going to say to the administration, no more contact with a man who's got
government.
A nuclear weapon.
Right. And I have another one more very important thing to say, that how can they overlook that? I mean, there is a possibility that Pakistan's nuclear government has, nuclear scientists have helped Al-Qaeda and Taliban to make them a dirty bomb or to make a nuclear bomb.
I want to turn to Ahmed Rashid on this because, Ahmed, it's included in one of the pieces that you wrote for the BBC recently, which sort of made my eyebrows go up, and that is that many of Pakistan's nuclear scientists are committed Islamic fundamentalists. And is there a risk in what Ajay's suggesting that if the U.S. were simply to say we want nothing more to do with the military, with the official side of the country, that you've created a rogue state that does have the bomb?
Well, it's a fact that I think a lot of this proliferation was justified by Qadir Khan and other scientists on the basis of Islamic solidarity, especially with, you know, a very dubious argument, I would argue. But anyway, I mean, that's what they certainly argued. And Khan is on the record many times talking about Islamic solidarity and how more Muslim countries should have had the bomb to counter the Israeli bomb, etc. Now, and we know that, you know, right after 9/11, several of the scientists working on the nuclear program were caught after visiting Afghanistan and meeting Osama bin Laden. So I think, you know, there is a strong residue of Islamic fundamentalism there, and I think quietly what's probably going to happen is the Americans are going to put pressure on Pakistan now to vet many of these scientists. In fact, people have been telling me that probably a lot of the scientists who have served 25 years in these organizations are probably going to be prematurely retired. Now, all that is very good, but I think the fact is that this has been going on such a long time, and this proliferation has been going on over 2 decades now,
yeah.
And you certainly have a very, this kind of ideological justification has penetrated very, very deeply.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cambridge next. Victor's with us. Victor, go ahead.
Oh, all I want to say is this is one more addition to the United States foreign policy is always behind these shadow governments, these terrorist organizations. We kind of built the Taliban with the Pakistan. We built Al-Qaeda with Pakistan. We unleashed these people, these organizations, on their own civil peoples. I keep on hearing that we go around spreading democracy, but honestly, I don't find one case in which we develop democracy anywhere, but just mayhem and terrorist organizations and friendships with militaries and dictators.
So what would you have the Bush administration do, Victor?
The Bush administration do?
What would you have them do, yeah?
Well, if for once we could say, the other day they tried to say that we no longer should do visa with dictators, that it didn't work out, we should actually come up and say, well, you know, we have misbehaved in the past, we have done this for a long time, our game is up, nobody trusts us anymore, let's try a better way, let's try the real decent way, which is preach what you say, you know. If we want to develop democracies, let's do that.
All right, let me stop here if I can, Victor, and bring Kathy in, because, Kathy, one of the things that is a part of this that we've not spoken of yet is how much is going on that we don't know about. For example, how much in this cooperation between America and Pakistan means that there is some measure of American control over, you know, who has access to the nuclear button in Pakistan. Is that something where, you know, obviously it would be in the interest of neither the U.S. nor Pakistan to talk about it, but can we assume that that's changed in the last couple of years?
I think that the military is in complete control of the nuclear button.
The Pakistan military.
Pakistan. The Pakistan military, for sure, is in complete control. I think they're certainly since post 1998, when both India and Pakistan exploded their underground nuclear bombs, the testing, that there has been behind-the-scenes involvement in command and control systems. How do you, develop these systems in both countries? How do you prevent accidental nuclear exchanges? What kind of early warning systems? I think there's been a lot of that, Dick, that probably has been going on since 1998 in Pakistan and probably in India as well. I think that one thing that I think probably has been happening since, as Amit said, back in 2001 when this Powell was asked about this whole nuclear exchange and Qadir was dismissed, that there probably has been a lot going on since then in terms of hunting down the network, figuring out where the secrets were moving, how they were moving. And even though publicly, as Amit said, you know, everybody in Pakistan figures that a deal has already been cut between the Bush administration and the military, I think that's probably true. I mean, I'm sure that's true, and that they have been, that the U.S. administration now knows what kind of a network was set up, who was involved, how was involved. So I think that while we're talking about this publicly, I think that a lot has been happening since 2001 for sure, and maybe even before. And so I think probably while we're talking about the military's involvement, I think the U.S. administration probably is quite well aware of the military's involvement, and this isn't coming as a surprise to them.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Burlington, Massachusetts. Vin's joining us now. Vin, thanks for calling.
Hello, this is Vin Joshi here. I'm calling from Burlington. I wanted to say something which is a bit different from what your expert is saying and from one of the callers said. They said that U.S. government should not support Musharraf and things like that. And I feel exactly the opposite. I feel exactly the opposite because it seems that he is the likely person to control the radical elements and the extremists in Pakistan. Today, the fact of the matter is, yes, military is the most powerful entity in Pakistan, and the change the change should happen from there, in the sense somebody should rise within the ranks of military to a higher position, and that person, when he has risen to that highest level, he should be the one who should be changing.
Vin, the general, the top general, has risen as high as you can get in Pakistan. He's the president of the country.
Yes.
He makes all the decisions there.
Yes, and I think that, and that's what I'm saying, that that is the good sign. That's a good sign over here, because if a politician or if a person who is from the civil society, if he comes to the top, the military won't let him be at the top, because the military controls everything. So if that is the case, let somebody from the military come, and that is exactly what has happened. And now that it has happened, it is time for the U.S. government to essentially support this person so that he can control the radical elements. I mean, though he has...
Then let me take that point, if I can, and ask Ahmed to join us here, because it's an argument that is often made in the United States, Ahmed, that regardless of however dirty Musharraf's hands might be for his seizing power or whatever, he may be the only person who can control radical elements in Pakistan. Is that a correct argument? Is that a good case to make?
I think, you know, I mean, somebody like myself has never argued that you have to, you can't totally dump the military in Pakistan simply because they have been so powerful and they have dominated the political scene, the nuclear program, foreign policy, etc. But I think, you know, what this administration has utterly lacked has been any kind of nuance, you know, post 9/11 towards this military. It has given in on so many counts. I mean, Musharraf has banned some of these radical extremist groups in Pakistan two or three times in the last 2.5 years. And he has to keep banning them because actually nothing is ever done about them. And they keep reappearing, and then the Americans object, and then they're banned once again. Yesterday, the leader of one of these banned groups, Hafiz Saeed, the leader of Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, one of the major extremist groups in Pakistan, was on the Mall Road in the main street of Lahore demonstrating against Musharraf and in favor of Qadir Khan. Now, this man is supposed to be under arrest. He's wanted. Musharraf had promised not only to ban his party but to arrest him. He was demonstrating quite publicly yesterday, and again today, let me tell you, on the day of the strike, he was out again today. Now, when these kinds of things happen, you wonder, well, I mean, what on earth is going on? Why is this man being allowed to demonstrate and whip up public opinion and public emotions against the Americans, against the Indians, against anyone? So I think, you know, there's been an acceptance of by the U.S. that the military is going to play a two-track game with the Americans. And that, I think, is becoming more and more difficult now, because we've seen, you know, George Tenet last night in his address at Georgetown, the CIA chief said
I'm going to have to stop you there, Ahmed, because we're taking a short break here. I'm glad you brought up the point about George Tenet. He certainly did talk about it, and we'll hear his voice when we come back after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about news this week from Pakistan. Its lead nuclear scientist goes on television, confesses that he has been selling secrets around the world. He is officially pardoned by the president. Pakistan military leadership would like the story to end right there, but of course it will not. One of my guests, Ahmed Rashid, was mentioning just a couple of seconds ago that this was the subject or one of the subjects addressed in a speech by the CIA director, George Tenet, at Georgetown University yesterday, taking advantage of the fact that now this is in the public. He put his own directorial spin on what happened in Pakistan.
First, we discovered the extent of Khan's hidden network. We tagged the proliferators. We detected the network stretching across 4 continents, offering its wares to countries like North Korea and Iran. Working with our British colleagues, we pieced together the picture of the network, revealing its subsidiaries, its scientists, its front companies, its agents, its finances and manufacturing plants on 3 continents. Our spies penetrated the network through a series of daring operations over several years. Through this unrelenting effort, we confirmed the network was delivering such things as illicit uranium enrichment centrifuges. And as you heard me say in the Libya case, we stopped deliveries of prohibited material.
CIA Director George Tenet speaking yesterday at Georgetown University. So how much has the United States known about this all along? And what should the United States do now to discover that one of its allies in the so-called War on Terror has been involved in peddling secrets, nuclear secrets, around the world? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones, to Durham, North Carolina. Cash is joining us. Cash, thanks for calling.
Hey, Dick, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Something is not right here. We went off the country, Iraq, here, because we thought that they had nuclear weapons with sketchy intelligence. But on the other hand, here we have a country that has nuclear weapons for sure, and that's been spreading the weapons around. And we don't do anything about that. Just a sorry is enough to just let them go. A previous caller here said that our false concerns about democracy. I think we have false concerns about nuclear non-proliferation too. We preach that we have we're serious about nuclear non-proliferation, but are we really serious about that?
Okay, so if President Bush were to answer your question, Cash, by saying, so what would you have me do? We need the assistance of the Pakistani military in our war on terror, in our hunt for bin Laden. What would you have me do? What would you tell the president?
I would tell him that Pakistan is obligated to actually help us to actually do something about it. It's not that they're doing us a big favor by helping us. It's an obligation for having created Taliban, for having created Al Qaeda, what Afghanistan did. Pakistan is equally responsible. So it's upon them to clean up the act, and they just have to do it.
Let me bring Kathy Gannon in here, because it's not really clear to most of us who watch the stories there from this part of the world, Kathy, whether or not the Pakistan military is playing it straight up with the U.S. administration, saying, yes, we're doing all we can to help you find bin Laden. I mean, we still see stories about Pakistani volunteers going across to fight with, the whatever the Taliban is now in Afghanistan. And those borders aren't closed or controlled in any way that they might be, right?
Sure. And I think it's as Amit said, in this two-track policy, I think in terms of Al-Qaeda or Osama, I think that if they had them, they would turn them over. Al-Qaeda people have been turned over. Taliban, that's a different story. And certainly I think that there is assistance given to Taliban leaders. It's part of it is Pakistan hedging its bet that they think in Afghanistan the government there is not a particularly friendly one to them, more pro-India. And so the Taliban are hedging their bet type strategy. So I think that's very true. Is the border closed? Absolutely not. Is it possible to close the border? Absolutely not. But are they trying? I don't think so. I think that it is the military. It's not the intelligence as a ISI as a rogue sort of institution doing that. I think it's
ISI is the Pakistan equivalent of the
Pakistani
CIA.
Exactly. I'm so sorry. The Pakistani equivalent of the CIA. And that is controlled by the military, controlled by Musharraf. And so I think that's very true that you're not getting the assistance in that way. And also I'd like to make the point, too, that the caller who said that, maybe Musharraf is the ticket to controlling these radical elements. If you look at Pakistan post-1999, when the military took over, regardless if you say, okay, that's fine, they took over, but the religious right now controls two provinces in Pakistan. During that flawed attempt at democracy for 10 years when never did Pakistan give more than 6-9% of the popular vote to the religious right. Now, post-military control, they control two provinces, those two key provinces that are right on the border. The madrasas have not been controlled. Emmett is absolutely right. You cannot throw the military out completely. You have to deal with them. But you can force them to allow the civil society to take charge and to put them back into the barracks and to find a way to make Pakistan a long-term stable friend as opposed to short-term for short-term gain.
Okay, but Kat, let's talk about the short-term, really, because I think what I'm hearing Ahmed say is that the United States doesn't have any other friends in that region, that the United States is, like it or not, forced to maintain something of a cooperative relationship with the Pakistan military as long as it is prosecuting this multi-pronged war on terror. Ahmed, if I'm mischaracterizing what you're saying.
But Dick, you have to also call the military to task for when they are not doing what they're saying they're going to do. So if they are as dependent on you as you are on them. So you have to call them to task when they are not controlling their radicals,
right,
when they are not taking steps to control the madrasas, when they are not developing a political system, allowing the political system to develop. You have to take them to task on it, which is not being done at all.
Well, precisely. I mean, I think that's what is totally missing, what I said earlier. There is just no nuance in U.S. policy. It is a black and white, you know, it's Musharraf or chaos, which is how, you know, the State Department presents the policy to the American people. If we don't have Musharraf, well, Pakistan will break up or there'll be chaos and the fundamentalists will get the bomb. It's not, I mean, that is not the, you know, that is not the way it should be presented, and that's not the real situation here. You have political parties here. You have groups who are trying to fight the fundamentalists. I mean, you know, secular political parties who are trying to oppose them. You have, you know, NGOs. You have educationalists. You have tens of thousands of people who are trying to do all sorts of things to set up a democratic society. And none of them get any kind of hearsay from the Americans right now. Now, I just want to go back to what George Tenet said. I think George Tenet, I think, really put his foot in it. And I think this is going to really reverberate in the United States for the next few days. He admitted in the clip that you played, he admitted that the CIA had penetrated this network quite some time ago. Now, the question then arises that why didn't the Americans blow the whistle quite some time ago? Why did it take for Iran and for Libya to come out and say, well, actually, you know, all our designs are based on Pakistani designs, before the Americans came out and put the pressure on Musharraf? Now, I think, you know, what Tenet is saying there is that the CIA knew quite some time ago, and I think, you know, that question has to be asked of this administration as to what they've been doing then with all this information.
1-800-423-8255 to Nashville, Tennessee. Bill's joining us on the line. Bill, thanks for calling.
Yes, perhaps one of the unintended consequences of the war in Iraq, and particularly the way it was prosecuted, was that it, in essence, fleshed out these folks with nuclear material and technology from Pakistan.
It may, in fact, have fleshed those people out in Libya and in Iran, people more willing to say, you can come and look what we have, rather than contemplating the possibility of being attacked. Is that what you're saying, Bill?
Yes.
And so where do we go from here? I mean, do you just sort of say, you know, mark that as a plus on the attack Iraq side and move forward? Or do you think that that's an indicator that the United States ought to continue to wield preemption as a tool that it's ready to use?
Well, I think that it opens a possibility for more subtlety and a more nuanced approach at this point. If the administration can shift gears and take that, if they continue in a somewhat cowboy-like approach, then they could miss that opportunity.
Bill, thanks for your call. I wonder if I can turn back to both my guests to get your sense of what happens next in Pakistan, because it's how that story plays out in that country, which is in many ways going to provide the opportunities or the routes for the United States to continue its involvement with Pakistan. I mean, someone, and Kathy, why don't you start on this? Someone like A.Q. Khan could, in fact, become a real hero in Pakistan. He could become a politician, a political leader, because he's one of these people who seem to have stood up. Now, can you see that happening? Would it go that far?
Well, I think he already is a national hero, and, you know, and does already sort of embody a certain amount of national pride. I think in terms of him emerging as a political leader, I think that you already have, you know, a variety on the playing field, you know, the religious extremists,
right,
who already use that. So and are now quite politically present in Pakistan and actually in control of two provinces. So I think the landscape, the Pakistani political landscape, is already out there. I don't know that this particular crisis is going to, unless there's some real thoughtful change within the U.S. Administration's policy toward Pakistan, I think that it's not going to really change the landscape a lot. At least I don't see it. Maybe Emmett probably is much better able to say.
Well, does Musharraf get his wish, Ahmed? Does this go away now that the scientist has confessed and been pardoned and locked up in his house again?
No, I mean, I don't think it's going to go away internationally, and that means that it's not going to go away in Pakistan either. You're going to get now, you know, even if the U.S. is satisfied with what he's done, it doesn't mean that the Europeans or the Japanese, for example, who have a huge problem with North Korea and the proliferation to North Korea, or the IAEA, or the Democratic contenders at the moment in the United States, or the U.S. Congress, is going to be satisfied with this. And I think this story is going to run and run, and we are just getting today, I mean, we've got stories from Malaysia, from China, from North Korea, talking about the fallout of this proliferation in those respective countries. Now, I think the story is going to run and run, and there are going to be many more revelations, and eventually I think there are going to be revelations in the U.S. media about the amount that the U.S. government knew two or three years ago and didn't take any steps to rectify the situation, you know, because of 9/11 and because of Iraq and because of other contingencies. So, you know, as long as this kind of international fallout is going to continue, which I think it will, mm-hmm. it is going to have a big impact in Pakistan.
And Kathy, your morning paper these days is a New York paper. You're spending mm-hmm. some time with the Council on Foreign Relations. Do you see the revelations from Pakistan as having a serious impact on the investigations that are promised and pending here in this country?
Sure. I think they have to. I think they have to have. And I think it'll come out over time, you know, as more and more questions are asked and questions like, how long has the U.S. administration known? What exactly have they known? How involved have they been in terms of not coming forward with information? And I think the IAEA is going to be asking some pretty hard questions as well. And so I think that is going to really expose some of the U.S. Foreign policy. And so I think, yeah, I think it's going to really cause a lot of reverberations here in the United States and with this administration.
Kathy, so good to have you on the program again.
Thank you. So good to be here, Dick.
Kathy Gannon, fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, on leave from her other job as Bureau Chief of Associated Press in Islamabad earlier, or rather also joining us from Lahore, Pakistan, Ahmed Rashid. Nice to have you with us, Ahmed.
Thank you.
Ahmed Rashid is a correspondent with the Far Eastern Economic Review and author most recently of a book on Taliban and jihad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.